Welcome back to the program. To paraphrase an old marketing expression, science, it's not just for nerds anymore. In fact, if we want to fully understand the human condition, including our sexuality, our relationships, our desires, we need to understand science. Every month in Scientific America and Slate, our guest today, Jesse Baring, brings these issues to the forefront of our consciousness. Now he's brought them all together in a new book entitled Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? Jesse Baring is a regular contributor to Scientific America and Slate. His writing has appeared in New York Magazine, The Guardian, and The New Republic. He's the author of the previous book, The Belief Instinct, and he is the former director of the Institute of Cognition and Culture at the Queen's University, Belfast. It is my pleasure to welcome Jesse Baring here to talk about why is the penis shaped like that. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. Before we get into some of the specifics of some of the things you talk about and some of the scientific journeys you take us on, I want to talk about the broader idea that in many ways science takes away, in a good sense, a lot of the kind of misguided but sometimes romantic notions we have about things concerning sexuality and our relationships.
Right. I do think it's an issue, actually. I think that there are many people who actually value the mystery more than the actual scientific explanation. So there is a contingent, I think, of the human population that would prefer not really to understand the mechanistic details, the sort of reductionistic science that I get into with this book.
For a lot of it, we've always sort of labored under the illusion that they were, from a psychological perspective, evolutionary reasons why certain things were the way they are.
Right.
What you bring to the fore is that there are clearly evolutionary biological reasons why.
Right. I mean, to me, that is the most satisfying journey that I take in the writing, is to actually find out why things are the way that they are, and why, not only why they look anatomically, like the shape of the penis, for example, but also our psychological profiles, our behavioral responses, and how those are likely the residue of hundreds of thousands of years of natural selection.
And yet these are things that are just now beginning to reveal themselves to science. We're in kind of a golden age, one could maybe argue, in terms of understanding all of this. Why is that? Why now?
Well, that's an interesting question. It is absolutely bizarre, if you think about it, that only within the past 20 years or so have researchers ever even bothered to answer the question about, you know, the shape of the human penis. Or the chemical composition of seminal fluid. Nobody ever looked at that before. It was sort of one of those things that we just, I think, was just too close to our everyday existence that we failed to really look at it adequately. But I do think that this is sort of the final frontier, or, you know, one of the last frontiers of scientific exploration, is exploring our own bodies.
It's something that we were uncomfortable about understanding, uncomfortable about hearing about, and uncomfortable about talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that, you know, probably underlying this is just this recognition that, or what it does is bring home the point that we are animals. And I think that is intuitively discomforting to many people.
Talk about why that is in the context of understanding evolution.
Well, I mean, there are numerous sort of explanations for why that would make us uncomfortable. I think, you know, one of the more convincing ones from a psychological perspective is that it reminds us that we are mortal, that we are bodies that will eventually die and decompose, and that our neural systems, our brains, basically produce our psychological experiences, and our minds will cease to exist when our brains stop working. So I think that, although that might not be articulated explicitly in people's responses and why they don't like to understand that they're animals, numerous psychologists believe that that's probably what drives the fear.
And in terms of some of the things that you talk about and why is the penis shaped like that, there's often a kind of ick factor that people have talking about some of these things.
Yeah. I mean, disgust is at the heart of our aversion to talking about these types of questions, and it makes sense. But I also kind of have fun with that disgust factor, because that's also what makes it interesting to me. It's fascinating. It's bizarre. It's bizarre, but it's so common. And the disgust, I think, will, you know, it pulls people in sort of as in a voyeuristic way, but it also reveals quite a lot about us in terms of why we have that disgust.
Why do we? What is it that's inherent in simply understanding our biological anthropology that repels us in some ways?
Well, when we're talking about disgust with sexuality, it's really, you know, one of the things that can put off our Well, if you probably notice that when you are really aroused, or anybody else who's ever who's listening to this that's ever been extraordinarily aroused, disgust actually diminishes the disgust diminishes when we are turned on, basically. But it flares up when we are sort of in the cold, sober state of just sort of rational explanation. And it, you know, the disgust is probably adaptive at some point because it would put us off from engaging in sexual behavior that might not be terribly advantageous.
And in many ways, it serves as a kind of check on us that is what separates us from animal behavior.
Yes. So it would be I suppose it would be difficult actually to measure the disgust or sort of aversive response in other species. We certainly hear that when people describe how they're reacting when they're talking about these types of things through language with human beings, but it's difficult to measure empirically whether other species actually would get disgusted at certain types of bodily fluids and so on.
We don't know that, obviously. Even the primates can't provide that information. Talk a little bit about the reaction that you have gotten to this from people you've talked to since the book has come out.
Well, it's a broad range of responses. I think some people misinterpret a scientific exploration of these types of issues and these topics as somehow my implicit endorsement or advocacy of some of the things that I talk about. And, you know, I cover all sorts of things in the book. I talk about zoophilia, people who have a sexual orientation where they're primarily attracted to other species over other people. I talk about the different erotic age orientations, including pedophilia. And also gerontophilia, people who are attracted to the elderly. I talk about some research on the effects of telling people that there is no such thing as free will and how that affects their social behavior, typically making them more selfish. And I think just the fact that I talk about these things for some people makes it uncomfortable because there's the assumption of an agenda or some type of idea that I somehow favor these types of things that I'm discussing, but in fact, what I'm simply doing is playing the tour guide and laying out how there are these people in the world, and this is how they came to be.
It's interesting to try and understand which behaviors then have deep biological roots versus those things that clearly can be objectively defined, I suppose, as aberrant behavior.
Right. So there are certainly cases in the book where I talk about legitimate sort of psychiatrically defined certifiable mental illnesses, but the issue, I think, in that word deviant is quite a loaded term. It's a strong term. From one point of view, of course, it simply means statistical deviance are moral ascriptions to those types of behaviors, and our evaluation of them as being inherently wrong is something that we use using our evolved minds to sort of determine whether they are acceptable or not acceptable. They don't necessarily have some sort of intrinsic wrongness in and of themselves.
The other thing that comes to mind is how we tend to perceive sexual behavior and sexuality in other people. I mean, we tend to look at it or not look at it with respect to people we know, friends, neighbors, etc. It's something that we kind of repel against, yet we're quick to want to hear about it with respect to celebrities or people that are famous. And there's an interesting irony.
Well, especially people that we're attracted to.
Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, this is a really interesting question because one of the things that sort of got me thinking a lot about this is that when we're interacting with people on the street, in the grocery store, all the, potentially hundreds of people that we see on any given day, every single person has their own unique sexual autobiography. We don't typically think of everybody in sexual terms, but that doesn't mean that they don't have these experiences, that it wasn't central to their lives. And I think just sort of the recognition of the universal nature of people learning about their sexuality, struggling with their sexuality, but not being able to talk about it very openly, to me was a very humanitarian question. I spent last year actually at the Kinsey Institute in Bloomington, Indiana State University, and I read people's descriptions. People used to send these old school sexologists their sexual autobiographies, like all the way back to the 1920s. And the things that people were describing in such intimate detail is very much like what we still see today. So we might not think of our great-great-grandmother having, having female ejaculations, but that doesn't mean that she wasn't. It's just something that you know, that's one of the many topics that people don't talk about very openly, but it's still very human.
Right. I mean, they don't talk about it any more openly today than they did back in, you know, grandmother's time.
Right.
But yet all those things were still going on, and evolution moves, as we know, very, very slowly.
Right. And I think that we like to think that we're more sort of open-minded now and sort of intellectually sophisticated and can talk about these things without cringing, but I don't think so. I mean, I think that we are still deeply uncomfortable with our sexuality.
How much of that has to do with religion?
I think quite a bit. I mean, I think that the religious sort of perspective infuses the moralistic views, of course, something being inherently wrong or inherently bad. But I don't think that it necessarily captures everybody's aversion to talking about these types of things, because there's certainly atheists, for example, more sort of scientific materialists that are also uncomfortable with this. You know, a lot of readers in Scientific American, for example, are more sort of the engineering bent, mm-hmm. Or the hard sciences, as they call them, the sort of biological sciences, not the soft sciences, which include psychology. And there's not so much of an eagerness to explore these types of issues.
Talk about what the cutting edge is now of this science. What are we trying to figure out? What don't we understand?
Well, there are lots of things that we don't understand. I think that one of the most significant points of progress in investigating the sexual response in human beings is these more sophisticated measurement devices that actually capture people's sexual arousal to a broad variety of stimuli. The most famous example is the penile plethysmograph, which basically measures the degree of tumescence or erection to a variety of targets. And the reason this is so important is because people will oftentimes either not be aware of what actually is arousing them, or they're not willing to say explicitly what makes them sexually excited at the most. So the penis doesn't lie, in other words. And I think that it can tell us quite a bit about human sexuality that is suppressed or isn't necessarily something that people are willing to share. Unfortunately, it's used for the most part now only studying sexual deviations, sort of the more atypical or abnormal types of arousal responses. And it's typically used in forensic settings, only with people who have already committed some type of sexual offense. Mm. But I think that it would be enormously advantageous to apply that to a broader sampling of the human population. And there are female versions of sexual arousal as well, measures of sexual arousal as well, that would also be used.
And when we combine this kind of research with things like functional MRIs, we get a much broader picture of all of this.
Absolutely. And I think, and that is sort of that's the frontier, looking at the sort of cognitive neurocognitive mechanisms underlying different types of sexual orientations. There are people who are, for example, trying to really sort of pinpoint the precise neurological cosmology of pedophilia. What exactly goes wrong in the brain that leads somebody to be attracted primarily to prepubescent children? And can we identify those people sort of before they commit some type of heinous sexual offense?
Of course, even in a more positive or uplifting way, the idea of understanding all of this better makes us think that somehow we can shape children or program children or ourselves in some cases to be different about certain things, to change in some ways.
I think, I think just simply understanding what causes people to behave sexually in different ways is critically important. I think that it changes our perspective of why people do what they do, and our sympathy and sort of our understanding of other people making decisions that we wouldn't necessarily make. And I think that's very important. And I think the more literate we are with respect to those types of questions, and the more knowledgeable we are, the better poised we are to solve meaningful social problems.
Right. Talk about that from both an evolutionary perspective and also in terms of the broader moral perspective of this kind of empathy, of understanding that there are reasons why people do the things that they do.
Well, one of the underlying themes in my book and my personal academic mm-hmm. research was studying social cognition in human beings, and looking at whether we are the only species, or perhaps the species that is best equipped to think about the intentions and psychological states of others, basically using our empathy. And all of the evidence at the moment sort of points toward this direction, that human beings are natural psychologists, is the term. We're constantly trying to understand why people do what they do. And chimpanzees, our closest living relatives, might have some degree of that, but it's certainly not at the level in which we do.
Mm-hmm.
But we also make lots of errors in terms of trying to understand other people's motives for their behaviors. So we're constantly having to correct our theories of why people do what they do, and the science is really sort of the only way to understand it rationally.
And what do we learn about people that are asexual, that are seemingly indifferent?
Right. Well, there is a community of individuals. There's a fairly healthy sized demographic, about 1% of the population, that claims that they have never been attracted to either men or women. They simply have no discernible sexual response to not only other human beings, but no other species. So they're not zoophiles or anything like that. They're not pedophiles. They're not attracted to differently aged people. It's simply that they don't have any attraction to any other human being on the face of the earth. And it's not that they have an aversion to sex necessarily. They're just simply more indifferent. So a lot of asexuals actually will have sex, but it's not enjoyable to them. They have no particular motivation or desire. They do it to please their partner, who just, you know, for that person's sake, it's kind of like taking out the garbage.
Right.
But they don't really enjoy it themselves.
I mean, the interesting thing about that is the evolutionary part of it, because
right.
It goes counter to the desire to repopulate the species, essentially.
Right. So it's very difficult to understand, really, sort of the absence of any type of arousal to any human being on the face of the earth ever over the course of a lifetime. And there are some critics of the actual existence, basically sort of doubting the actual existence of asexuals that would fit this bill, that are otherwise sort of hormonally normal. I mean, basically these people, we would have to rule out any type of health problems or medication that is diminishing their sexual drive. This is a lifelong orientation for them, the absence of an orientation, basically.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the flip side of that would be what you talk about with respect to people that have suffered certain kinds of brain damage and the hypersexuality that grows from that.
Right. And I should say also about the asexuality in terms of reproductive success and so on, it might be more understandable from a female perspective, because a woman doesn't, of course, need to have an orgasm to conceive. So in the ancestral past, a woman that was asexual wouldn't have necessarily been selected against or weeded out of the genetic pool. From the male point of view, of course, it's quite different. A male really needs to sort of be motivated to have sex, to enjoy an orgasm with another partner, to populate.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there are interesting brain disorders and different types of dysfunctions in which you find a complete hypersexuality, where the person is engaging in all types of things that makes them, you know, even criminal sexual behavior that is completely uncommon to their normal personality. So a woman, for example, who had Kluver-Bucy syndrome, which is one of the types of disorders in which you find hypersexuality, all of a sudden started soliciting her family members for sex, and she was, you know, normally a very conservative, kind of prudish woman. They brought her into the emergency room at the local hospital. She started performing fellatio on one of the elderly men in the cardiac unit. And she couldn't control herself. I mean, it was simply beyond her rational decision making. Her sex drive had simply skyrocketed as a product of these neuronal problems.
Historically, what do we find to be the nexus between this and pornography?
Well, pornography would basically be the culmination of the types of stimuli that we found most stimulating from an evolutionary perspective. So there is actually evolutionary work on the science of pornography. There's not a lot of it, but one of the interesting findings is that men tend to prefer pornography that includes multiple men with fewer women, which is counterintuitive if you think about it. You wouldn't think that many heterosexual males would actually want to see multiple males have sex with a single woman. You'd expect kind of the opposite ratio. But the argument is that men would have gotten extraordinarily aroused by the fact that other men are having sex with a desirable female partner, and because it increases the sperm competition between them. And that is sort of, that actually sort of articulates with the title of the book, why is the penis shaped like that?
Which does bring us back around to the first question, why is the penis shaped like that?
Well, the short answer is that it's designed to retract the semen, and specifically the sperm cells of rival males that would have had sex with that same woman within a fairly short period of time, about 48 hours, within a 48-hour period of time, which is the lifespan of your average sperm cell. So the critical part of the penis, in this sense, is the coronal ridge, which is underneath the bulbous sort of glands head that pulls out the sperm cells. The deeper of other males, the deeper you thrust into the vaginal canal, the more sperm cells you're likely to pull out. So there are all sorts of interesting kind of side hypotheses that are related to that. One is that most men will typically get flaccid pretty much immediately after having an orgasm once they ejaculate. Doesn't really feel good, doesn't feel comfortable anymore, and that's adaptive, the argument is, because it would be self-defeating to continue having sex and pull out your own sperm cells. We also fall asleep, because that sort of somnambulistic effect.
How is this different from other species, even when we look at primates?
Well, our penises are very different than the penises of other primates, even chimpanzees. I mean, chimpanzee penises are basically all shaft. There's no glands head, but they have extraordinarily large testicles. Unlike our testicles, are kind of average size from a phylogenetic or primate perspective. And the argument is simply that we've evolved different sexual competition mechanisms. Chimpanzees basically have very large volumes of sperm in their ejaculate and very potent sperm cells. And they're highly promiscuous. We are kind of more sort of middle ground in terms of our promiscuity. I mean, clearly, the design of the human penis reflects the fact that we had multiple partners, but we also had a tendency toward monogamy. It's a tool. The penis is a tool, basically, that can tell us a lot about the particular ancestral past of a given species.
Jesse Baring, the book is Why is the Penis Shaped Like That? It's just out from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Jesse, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.